talk that long, and I know you can't sit that long, or shouldn't sit that long, one or the other. I'm gonna share first a little bit how I got involved in this environmental history project. In 1986, I was very fortunate to have one of my former students arrange an all-expense-paid field trip to the Amazon for me. It's not often my former students do that for me, but she was able to arrange this for me, and I went down with her and a group of Audubon individuals and spent a week in the Amazon, a week in the Ecuadorian Andes, and a week in the Galapagos Islands, and the biologist was phenomenal. The week in the Amazon and the concern for tropical deforestation and my realization that I was almost 50, I'm now over 50, this was 4 years ago, I was almost 50, I realized there was no way I was going to re-educate myself to be able to do anything major about the fantastic flora and fauna of the Amazonia. But I thought maybe I could make a contribution in a different way, and that different way was by studying deforestation in Michigan. We don't know very much. We know we cut the forest down, or we burn it, one or the other situation. But we don't know very much about that. And today, with so many people pointing fingers at Brazil with respect to the Amazon forest, I think we ought to, particularly those of us in Michigan, should point fingers at ourselves, our ancestors, with respect to the forests of Michigan. Not only that, but we ought to be concerned with reforestation here in Michigan, as well as urging the people in the Amazon not to make some of the mistakes that we made. That is one line that got me involved in this research project. The second line was 1986, which was just a year before the Sesquicentennial. So when I came back from the Amazon, people were very, you know, when I started talking to historians, they were all interested in the 150th anniversary of the state. And I was interested in that too, so there was some excitement. So that also led me to do something about it. And then there's a third line involved. We professors have a habit of talking too much, particularly at class. And I was talking with one of my colleagues, some of you may have known him, Dr. Richard Flanders, who's an archaeologist at Grand Valley, and who did some of the archaeological work on the Northern Mountains in Grand Rapids, and also on a little site adjacent Grand Valley State University called Glendon's Landing. And every time I would mention deforestation, knowing very little about it, but I would mention it, he would talk about Glendon's Landing, ghost town, lumbering town in Iowa County, right adjacent to campus of Grand Valley. And then he would make one of the most, as far as I was concerned, ridiculous statements in terms of history, in terms of Michigan history. For those of us who love railroads, and I happen to have that weakness, I have numerous weaknesses in that town, he would make the statement that there was a logging railroad in operation in Ottawa County at Glendon's Landing in the 1840s. I snickered to myself. I said, I know what the history books say. They say in 1878, and they say that it was up in Muskegon River Valley, and it was garish operations up there in 1878. Well, you know archaeologists, they have a hard time getting the right century, let alone getting the right decade. So I'm kind of, dismissed that. However, with these coming together, and somehow again I made some stupid statement in front of Dick Flanders, and he again said something about Glendon's Landing, and I said, I'm going to find out. I'm not going to listen to him one more year say some stupid remark about Glendon's Landing. So with those coming together, I started to try to find out. First thing I did was go to the history books, not the public, well, we would expect the Grand Haven and a little bit on Ottawa County, not much, just primarily Grand Haven. Looks Grand Rapids, that's Grand Rapids. Yeah, Granville almost doesn't exist as far as Grand Rapids is concerned in terms of history. And Glenwood Landing is in between, and it's not mentioned in either of the books, except just in passing. It was a landing there. When was there a landing? What happened there? And so were all questions that I was interested in. And I also happen to be interested because as a member of the university club, the faculty club at Grand Valley, I am a co-owner of that piece of property. So if he was right, it'd be nice to, when I go to a meeting of fellow railroad enthusiasts, to say I own the site where the, I'm one of the owners of the site where the earliest logging railroad in the United States ever operated, if he was right. Well, he wasn't quite right, but close enough to it, as it turned out. But anyway, that's where some of my interest came. Now, another part of this, there's a fourth reason for getting involved in this, and this one hasn't gone away, and it's called a little extra weight. And I thought that if I got involved in this environmental history project, I'd get out and do more hiking, which is indeed true. I have done a little bit more hiking. But I found myself sentenced to a microfilm reading machine. Because in order to figure out what's going on, you have to read microfilm. Microfilm of old newspapers. Microfilm of old trial records. And I'm sitting there looking at this, and everybody around me, of course, is doing genealogy, looking up names and so on. It's an interesting group that I run into with respect to this. But occasionally someone else is reading the newspaper, but they're looking up some sports score or something like that. But anyway, I did take it on to lose, and I have failed. I had high hopes in the future to get out and get some more exercise. But I have hiked many interesting places in the Grand River Valley, and I also have a weakness for a little place up on the upper peninsula called Grand Lake. So every now and then I'll go up there and do some research. Also, I located a log slide, a log chute, for example, that came down Pitcher Rocks into Lake Superior, some other interesting things up there. But my major goal is to get a book published on the logging history, environmental history of the Grand River Valley by 1993. When Bob Vandevoste dropped a little note to me and said, we are looking for speakers. I owed him one because when I first made a presentation on the Blend and Lumber Company, he said, you know, I know where there's some interesting letters relative to the Blend and Lumber Company. And they indeed were very interesting reading. And as a result, I owed him one. And so I said I would come. Now, keep in mind, this is research in progress. It is not completed. I don't have the kind of audiovisual show I would like to have. If I did, I would have come in with stereo playing the logging, the shanty tune, the shanty boy tunes, and this would be a well-organized slideshow. I got three trays up there. They're partially organized, but I had some problems with photography. We shot three rolls of film only to find out that the film didn't, the last roll didn't go, which had all my pictures in it, didn't go through the film, the camera. Little things like that happen and delay you. Now, another reason why I was willing to come now was this is the 100th anniversary of the last log ride in the Grand River Valley. The last log ride that went over the Grand Rapids, actually the dam in Grand Rapids. May the 11th, in 1890, the rear of the last log ride to ever reach Grand Haven and over the dam in Grand Rapids. So that's a century ago. That's a milestone. That's the end of an era with respect to history. And I think it's something that deserves some recognition. And one way of recognizing it is to speak about it. And consequently, that's another reason why I weakened. If it had been up to me, I'd have said, give me another year or two because I really have things put together. Well, let me give you a little bit of a history with respect to logging in Michigan and logging in the Grand River Valley and emphasizing Ottawa County in particular. they said a century ago, the last log drive to reach Grand Haven passed through Grand Rapids. The reporter described the loggers that kept the logs floating downstream on this last drive as a picturesque lot. I almost thought about dressing up the part, but there again, I didn't get the time to get to the appropriate places. Wearing woolen coats, pants tucked in their spike boots, and one of the individuals drowned in that last log drive. I think the individual was not a member of the log driving crew, but one of the citizens of Grand Rapids that clung out on the log. For more than 6 billion feet, board feet of white pine lumber were produced by the hundreds of sawmills that operated in Grand River Valley. More than 6 billion feet. We estimate about 160 billion feet came out of Michigan. And 6 billion of that 160 billion board feet came out of the Grand River Valley. The environmental economic history of logging sawmill in Europe in the Grand River Valley deserves more attention than it's received. It's indeed a legendary era for very good reasons. It was both romantic and dangerous. While logging opened up the land for settlement, it also involved the wasteful destruction of a valuable resource, mature growth forests. On the other hand, the loggers didn't log it, the farmers were going to burn it. So don't blame the loggers. The American ideal, the European ideal, was not a forest. The European ideal was a farm. And the forests were not viewed as chapels or any kind of way that we might view them today. There are very, very few people, a few poets and a few others, that view them in a way that many of us might tend to view them today. The forests of towering trees that once covered Michigan are virtually all gone. In fact, you can name where they are. They're still up. Hartwick Pines in the Lower Peninsula, there's one or two other very small locations, small clusters in the Lower Peninsula. Estevan Pines, right at the tip of the Kenai Peninsula, and I know of a couple of other locations as well. We face the problem of timber theft with respect to some of these small clusters. There was a small stand in Kent County in 1976, about 30 trees. It was cut down. And as an owner of the faculty, one of the co-owners of the faculty club property, every now and then someone goes in and steals one of our black walnut trees. I don't know about timber theft. Occurred in the past and it occurs today. Shanty boys, as the early loggers were called, converted forests into three things: saw logs, slashings, branches, and other material they didn't want, and stumps they left behind. Sawmills, in turn, converted saw logs into lumber, shingles, lath, slabs, and lots of sawdust. I would like to know how much of the filled-in area around Grand Haven, Spring Lake, Ferrisburg is sawdust. There's got to be a lot of it. Same is true, of course, and maybe even more so for Muskegon. Let me give you a description of how the settlers viewed the forest. And I'm quoting from a story of the name of John H. White. There was a time when America had wood to burn. The New World was seen as a sylvan wasteland that could never be civilized until the woodland was cleared for the plow and the highway. It was a land that would remain unfulfilled until cities rose in place of the wilderness. The forest was more than an impediment to progress. Its green umbrella offered shelter to the hostile savages. blocked out the purifying sunlight, and in general created a gloomy land of shadows, well suited to the devil's own work. The poet saw the native forest as nature's own cathedral, and the choir whispering furs, but the average colonist apparently lacked the same romantic vision and saw God's own cathedral as a major liability, and one that should be destroyed as quickly as possible. Chop the damn trees down, burn them in field and furnace, pile them in the ravine to rot, to clear the land of the forest, and make a quick path for civilization. Such an attitude seems unaccountable today, considering the ecology movement. And yet our reverence and concern would have been puzzling to our forefathers, who viewed timber as a surplus commodity with unlimited reserves awaiting the woodsman's axe. I think that's a pretty good description of how they viewed it. In my reading of Grand Rapids newspapers, and I've read 50 years on microfilm, I deserve a medal just for doing that, if nothing else. And I have read some of the Detroit newspapers as well. That attitude is fairly accurate. They were interested in clearing the land for fire. Now, logging began in the Grand River Valley in 1832 in the sense of operating a sawmill. The small Indian mission up by Grand Rapids had an upright saw operating in 1832. The Indians, realizing that times were changing, asked for help from the federal government to put in a sawmill, and they had a sawmill with one upright saw in operation in 1832. That sawmill provided the lumber for the first buildings in Grand Rapids that were built of logs, sawed logs, or in some cases they would just slab the log, basically, make it into blocks, and then also in other cases, the lumber. That sawmill provided the first lumber for Ionia, and that sawmill may very well have provided the first lumber for Grand Haven, because Grand Haven did not have a sawmill until 1836. Now, Yankees from New England saw money when they saw the tall white pine trees in the Grand River Valley. They faced five problems: problem of logging, problem of transportation of the saw logs, the problem of sawmilling, the problem of transporting the lumber, and the problem of selling it. Chopping down a mighty monarch of the forest was hard work, but was the least of their problems. Sawmill had to be within a short distance of the forest because it was difficult to move a heavy sawmill. Also, it had to be adjacent to a stream for water power, though a few mills at this time were employing steam boilers. And it had to be near a river so the lumber could be rafted to Lake Michigan. Now, since all the land north of the Grand River was still owned by the Indians in the early 1830s, the only forest that could be legally logged had to be located south of the river. The pine forest adjacent Buck Creek in southwestern Kent County were chosen by three different lumbermen in the same year, 1834. Buck Creek, you cross whenever you go into Grand Rapids. You cross it at the Jenison Interchange on I-196. Buck Creek and flows coming from the east, flows through Granville, and flows into the Grand River. Rush Creek flows from Georgetown Township into the Grand River at virtually the same location. Those two streams are the first two to be logged in a major way. One in Kent County, and then immediately the next year, Rush Creek in Ottawa County. That's where logging began in Granville and in Jenison. Well, there was no way that the lumbermen could compete in the New England lumber market. After all, the Maine lumber was there, New York lumber was there, and it was an awful lot closer for those people from Maine and New York. So they couldn't compete. However, there was a small town of about 3,000 people on the southwestern shore of Lake Michigan, where a couple of merchants had been advertising in a Detroit newspaper that they wanted to buy lumber. This small village named Chicago received its first shipment of white pine lumber in April of 1835. The lumber before that time was hardwood and from other locations. But the first white pine to ever be sold in Chicago came from Buck Creek and Kent County, from a mill operated by a man by the name of Roswell Britton and Nathaniel Brown. The Jennison family worked for them a year before moving on to Georgetown Township. Now, once they cut the lumber, the saw logs into lumber, they faced the problem of getting the lumber to Grand Haven. Fortunately, they had hired a Maine logger who knew how to build a lumber raft, which involved building a crib and then putting the lumber in it and floating the lumber that way. We took 600,000 feet of lumber that spring. That's no small amount of lumber to Chicago. And the lumbering era of the Grand River Valley was underway. Unfortunately, the lumbermen could convert pine forests into saw logs faster than the Chicago merchants could sell it. Financial panic of 1837 greatly slowed down the settlement to move west. A company called the Grand Haven Company, owned by Ricks Robinson Ferry and White, if I remember correctly, lost approximately $100,000 in their attempt to become a major lumbering company. Not unusual for these companies to go bankrupt. It took almost a decade to recover from the financial panic of 1837. 1837 was the first year that there was a sawmill on Black Lake. It was a ghost town, I'm sure many of you are well aware of, called Superior on the north shore of Black Lake. And it had an operating steam sawmill in August of 1837, when the steamboat Governor Mason from Grand Rapids visited. Steamboat Governor Mason did not just stay in the Grand River. He went out on Lake Michigan two or three times. One of the last times it sank. It was designed to operate on a river, and it got overwhelmed by the waves somewhere out near Muskegon. I would love to find someone interested in underwater archaeology to try to locate whatever remnants there are, the saws, the boilers, and what have you, that particular one. But anyway, in 1837, at Superior, there was an operating steam sawmill. And this is described in a newspaper article in the Detroit Press. I think it's called Free Press, or was it Democratic Free Press? I'm not quite sure. But anyway, that's the earliest mention of any operations in this area. Now, since this is the Holland area, and since I am Dutch, we're going to have some fun. Hollanders who came to this area were not well-versed in wood. Maybe for wooden shoes, but not certain other things. They learned very fast, however. Lumbering in the Black River area, Holland area. Okay, the Black River Harbor Association was the organization that company that operated the mill at Superior. Now, Van Ralty was responsible for my existing here rather than in Wisconsin. He was on his way to Wisconsin. Somebody else convinced him to stay here. I'll never know why. This time of year is tough on me because of the gray skies and so on that we usually get. So this has been a nice winter. I spent one winter on the other side of the lake, and had they all they gotten there, I think he would have stayed. They get more sunny days. This is the nicer side of the lake in the spring, the summer, and the fall, but not usually in January. Okay, well, anyway, Reverend Ben Ralty founded the Holland Colony in a forest, which the Hollanders had to clear away to make their settlements. They chopped down the trees and either burned them or converted them into cash. The forests in and around Holland were described as near town and for miles north, chiefly pine and hemlock. Actually, more hemlock than pine. With occasional lots of beech, maple, and oak. While in other directions, it is of all varieties, hardwood predominated. The bark of the hemlock trees was valuable because it contained chemicals important for what? Botanical. A Mr. Knox came over from Chicago in 1848 to show the Hollanders how to peel and cure the hemlock bark. The first export ever to leave the Holland colony was a shipload of hemlock bark. The wooden age had begun, and it wasn't wooden shoes. It involved the shipment of hemlock bark. Now, a Dutchman by the name of J. Bennekamp shipping, he shipped it aboard a schooner called the Amelia in 1848. The Hollanders employed a Mr. Gibbs from Kalamazoo to erect a sawmill for them. The Dutchman made the mistake of building a wind-powered sawmill. This was not the first wind-powered sawmill in North America. Hollanders had made the same mistake before over in New York, which was, I assume, then called New Amsterdam, in the 17th century. And someone made the same mistake earlier between that time, someone made the same mistake at Chicago in the early 1830s. They built a wind-powered sawmill that someone described as it used the wind and produced nothing but the wind, and it was a financial disaster. A Yankee visitor to the Holland colony describes the windmill as follows. This is an 1849 description. One of the greatest curiosities in the colony is the great awkward and unmanageable concern called the windmill. This is a monstrous wooden pile in the form of an octagon tower, large at the base and drawing to a small compass at the top. It is built of hewn timber, framed, and is about 60 feet in height. The machinery is wood, including the gudgeons of the wheel shafts, which are about 6 or 8 inches in diameter, covered with thin strips of iron. There are 2 saw frames, one having 9 and the other 6 saws. Those are what we call gain saws. Those are upright saws. And the advantage of 6 saws is you could saw one log all at once. And again, saw frame. These saws are placed as far apart as they intend to make the thickness of the stuff, and the log is sawed up by one passage of the saws through it from one end to the other, and the boards left with rough edges. The mill is moved by the force of the wind, striking it against 4 winding slats or flappers covered with canvas and attached in the center to a horizontal shaft. They were sawing, or attempting to saw, while I was there. Occasionally the saws would strike a few times, quite lightly, and then draw a few slower strokes, and the next moment stop entirely, perhaps to start up again in half an hour. And that was one problem. With a fair wind, they could saw a little, but in a lively gale, it was necessary to chain it up. And then the Yankee visitor says, enterprising individual is now putting up a good steam sawmill, which will do a better business. That's the earliest description I know of the sawmill operating here in Holland County. I'm not familiar with what you have here. I'm basing mine out of Grand Rapids newspaper. Here's another description, 1849, of this area. Because I think you need to have an appreciation of the forest. The face of the country and the neighborhood of the colony is pleasantly diversified with hill and valley, lake and stream. The streams are fed by large cranberry marshes, and overflowed lands can be easily drained, we expect that by judgment, easily drained by the hardy settlers for hay culture. The trees are mostly oak and pine, sugar pearl and bird's eye walnut, maple, walnut, wild cherry, and hemlock. Hemlock should be mentioned first. For agriculture, the lands are well adapted, and although it was at first anticipated that the colony would be unhealthy from the dark color of the water in the river, and at its outlet to the lake, indicating the soil was deeply filled with vegetable matter flowing from the muck swamps of great depth. Since the first year of the settlement of the colony, there have been a few deaths. The natural advantages of the colony and neighborhood for manufacturing purposes are very uncommon and highly gratifying to the colonists. Already two sawmills are in operation, a tannery in the progress of erection, shipyard, Fairville, all kinds of craft, live oak for the hulks, and for plank, magnificent pines for masts and spars are all in sight to the shore of the lake. Now, if we look at the 1850 census, the only industries operating in the Holland colony were wood products. One water-powered sawmill, one steam-powered sawmill, and one pearl ash factory involving the production of ashes by doing cordwood. In 1852, there was a stave factory. Very important. In fact, staves were important, I think, in Holland probably for a good 30 or more years. Staves were important for what purpose? Barrels. And that's how they shipped everything. In barrels, not just whiskey or molasses. We're talking about barrels being the basic packaging for almost any product. Okay, they had a stave factory which produced 900,000 white oak staves in addition to a shingle mill, as well as exporting lots of hemlock bark and leather from the tannery. Okay, those are all what? Wood products. No mention of exporting flour or grain, and there's a pretty good reason. This colony was growing fast. And they needed to feed what? Every year. A lot more new immigrants. So rather than exporting food, they were feeding people who were coming into the colony. Okay, that's a little description of the Holland area in the first 5 years or so, and I thought I would share that with you. But I'm going to pick up my history of the Grand River. See, Holland's not in the Grand River Valley. It's a little bit of a fluke of geological history because there isn't much elevation between Jennison, Granville, and Holland. It wouldn't take much to make Holland the port for the Grand River. In fact, several individuals had at one time or another proposed building a canal from Granville, Jennison to Holland, straighten out the Grand River. Well, something happened in 1848 to change things in Michigan. And it wasn't something that happened in Michigan. You want to know what I'm talking about? What? Well, the gold rush, but that got people to leave. I'm talking about selling products. That was too far away to really have much of an impact, except people left from Grand Rapids. I would be surprised if a few Hollanders didn't go from this area as well. There were people. What happened in 1848? Something really important. Chicago. What happened in Chicago? Huh? It just changed things. The exports going through Chicago doubled in almost 1 year. Building of a canal from Chicago to the Mississippi River, which made it possible for lumbermen in the Grand River Valley and the Skagit River Valleys, just say in Kalamazoo, because there was some white pine in Kalamazoo River Valley, to sell their lumber in the Mississippi River Valley at prices lower than those people in Wisconsin and Minnesota. so that canal was extremely important to understand what happens in terms of the economic history of Michigan, of the west side of the state. That canal is critical because the exports doubled. And I think it may explain something that happened that I found out about because Vandebussy drew my attention to some letters that someone in Holland must have retyped out of the Grand Rapids newspapers, and somehow they got into the Holland archives. And it was a letter by a man by the name of Edwin Thayer. And he was writing in 1900 to correct some statements made about history. And these were about the Blunden Lumber Company. No one wrote anything about Blunden Lumber Company when it was operating. I'm surprised anyone wrote anything about it when it wasn't operating. But fortunately, they got into a dispute in the newspapers. And as a result, Edwin Thayer wrote several very fascinating letters. And in one of these letters, Edwin Thayer mentioned that in the Grand River Valley, there were two logging off railroads that were built in 1850. Boy, did my eyes open up. I mean, I had an archaeologist friend tell me 1842, and I knew he was wrong. Well, I got 1850 for two horse-drawn logging railroads. I mean, rails means what? Doesn't have to be iron. We're talking wooden railroads. Why? They couldn't, these lumbermen couldn't get the logs to their mills fast enough. There are merchants in Chicago saying, get those logs, get the lumber here faster. We got markets. And Hopkins at Mill Point and Jabez Barber and Eastman were seeing dollar signs. And they built the first logging railroads in the Great Lakes and possibly the first logging railroads in the United States. Right here in Ottawa County. Hopkins built his, and Hopkins brothers built theirs in the Spring Lake. Some, probably somewhere up near Fruitport, I'm not exactly sure. They own considerable land, timber up around Fruitport. I'd love to figure out where, but all I found on that, in addition to the letter is the start, there's no description of the operation of that railroad except for a newspaper ad. When I read microfilm, I read the ads as well as the articles. In 1851, in the Grand River Times, there's a newspaper ad for someone to operate this railroad. Hopkins brothers built it, and they didn't want to operate. They wanted to operate the mill. And so they were advertising for someone to operate the logging railroad. That's the only documentary evidence of the existence of that logging railroad. But it's something. The other one was built in Allendale Township, just west of, about a mile west of the, of 68, about a mile west of Eastmanville. And I talked to the farmer on this property, it was, and we might be able to actually still locate the grave. I have no information about that, no documentary evidence, until last week, reading the Grand Rapids newspapers, I found the following. I'll just share this with you. This is, again, I read the ads, and I found an interesting ad in the Grand Rapids paper. Got a weakness for steamboats as well as logging railroads. And I'd seen this ad before, and I made a note of it, but I didn't see something. Let's see. Okay, this is a timetable for a steamboat Steamboat Michigan operating on the Grand River in 1853. And what I had done the first time was I quickly read all of the landings on the way to Grand Haven, but I didn't read all the landings on the way back. I thought they would be the same, just different times. And last week when I finally got around to making a copy off from microfilm, I was going through the line, okay, you leave Granville, you go to Hare's Landing, and there were Hare had a sawmill in the 50s and 60s at Hare's Landing. Sand Creek, there was at least one sawmill there. Looper's Landing, Carlston, there was a sawmill. Roberts, I believe, had a sawmill there one time. Dr. Eastman, at Eastmanville, there were several sawmills at various times. Dan Riley's, I'm not quite sure where Dan Riley's is, but I'm about to find out. I'm going to do some work search for that. Ottawa Center, Isla Robinson's, Velsey's Marsh, Alfred Robinson's, Nortonville, very important sawmill there. White's Mill, Ferry's Point, and Grand Haven. Okay, going out. Ferry's Point, White's Mill, Nortonville, Robinson's, Velsey's Marsh, Ira Robinson's, Ottawa Center, Barber's Railroad. That's the only documentary evidence in addition to a letter. The reason why I didn't accept the letter as documentary proof is the person who wrote the letter was 2 years old in 1850. He was describing something he never saw. And I learned the hard way to use what someone says as a way of searching for evidence, for documentary evidence. And that's my documentary evidence, not much, just one line, but that's my documentary evidence for the existence of Barber's Railroad. And so basically what I've done is checked out everything that a man by the name of Edwin Thayer said in his letter and found out to be accurate. Now remember, I have to remember is that Edwin Thayer was writing and criticizing someone else's view of history. He said, hey, that person was all wrong. This is the way it happened, not the way he said. Let me tell you. Well, was Thayer right or wrong? I didn't know. But what I've done has been to track down documentary evidence. Now we come to Blendon. Indeed, there was a logging railroad at Blendon. Indeed, it was before the Civil War. And indeed, it is deserving of historical recognition. Because while these two railroads I just mentioned used horses, and a third one built out of Stern's Bio to the center of Robinson Township by Gilder and then operated by Ferry, also used horses, this one used a steam locomotive and is the first railroad, logging railroad in the United States to use the steam locomotive. All this occurring in Ottawa County. Now, Blendon Lumber Company is a fascinating operation. It begins with John Ball. John Ball comes to Michigan as a land agent. He has $10,000 to spend, not his money. He has $10,000 of money from some Troy, New York investors to spend. $10,000. Some of it's in gold. Most of it is in bank drafts. This is in 1836. There was a real land rush in Michigan. He came to Grand Rapids, saw how much Louis Campaugh and Robinson were asking for, and others, Lyon, were asking for city lots, and did not buy it. He could do whatever he wanted with his $10,000. It was a blank check. You go and invest it. What he bought, he did buy some land adjacent Grand Rapids. That's why we got Leonard Street. It's named after one of the investors in Troy. But he decided to timber cruise, and this guy knew timber, because he had been all the way out to Oregon. He was the first school teacher in Oregon. He knew real big trees, Pacific Coast. Anyway, he timber cruised Ottawa County, and he got lost. Unusual. Anyone that's been hiking in an area they're not familiar with, it's very easy to get lost, and back then there were no road signs, not even section corners in many cases. If you knew what you were looking for, you could, in some cases, with the surveyors, marks and so on, you can locate yourself after that, but it takes some doing if you got yourself lost. Well, he got lost. First thing was with somebody else, and they built a fire overnight, and there's a little story in his autobiography of the wolves howling around the campsite, and he and his friend huddling as close to the fire as they could, trying to stay warm. And then on the way back, trying to find their way out, he stumbled on 2,500 acres of white pine. almost solid. That's unusual. Be that large on the stand south of the Grand River. And he purchased all 2,500 acres for the three investors. This is 1836, and he was going to share the profits. The problem is there were no profits, because what happened in 1837? The financial panic. So what he did was he turned the land over to the investors, and he got zero for all of his efforts, except food, and, you know, he kept alive because he had an expense account, but he gained. With the lumber prices continuing to soar from 1848 through 1855, they're going up and up and up. He got a letter from his investor friends, and his investor friends said, "We're going to log it. Problem is, it's several miles inland. It's not adjacent to Grand River, it's a few miles inland. And slaying is difficult. It's expensive. And a railroad you can operate almost year round." And so they ordered him to get the right of way for the railroad. And that's recorded in the Register of Deeds office. He made arrangements for the right of way for the railroad. So the first logging railroad to use a steam locomotive began operating in May of 1857. And Glendon Township. I don't know where Glendon Township got its name. If someone has a clue, I sure would like to hear it. This company operated for about 8 years. They built one of the largest sawmills on the Grand River at Glendon Landing. It had two circular saws and 40 gang saws. This was a huge logging operation and a huge sawmill. Unfortunately, the Civil War broke out. And the Civil War depressed lumber prices, particularly in the prairie states. So it was difficult to make much of a profit, though they continued using the logging railroad for until at least 1864, if not later. I find that a very fascinating part of history. During this period of time in history, there were no organized log drives the way you and I think of them. There were up in the Muskegon River, but not in the Grand River. Before the Civil War, logs were rafted. They were tied together some fashion and rafted. And in most cases, what they rafted were the lumber, not the logs, because they were sawing logs at Greenville, at Laffanville, which is Rockford. They were sawing up in Plainfield, Comstock Park area. They were sawing all along the Grand River. And they rafted their lumber to Grand Haven. There were also sizable mills in Grand Haven, in Spring Lake or Mill Point. And they got a lot of their logs from Crockery Creek. There are two streams in Ottawa County that they had log drives on. Some of you know Bass River, which is just on the western side of Allendale Township, drains large part of Glendon Township. They had a couple of log drives on the Bass River, and they had numerous log drives and lost their shirt numerous times in Crockery Creek. Crockery Creek Valley was rich in white pine. They couldn't figure out how to get it out. They kept losing money all the time because of the transportation problems. They could cut chocolate trees, that wasn't any problem. But getting them out after they cut them was the problem. And they lost their shirt on numerous occasions, and finally in 1888 or 89, Cutler and Savage built a railroad from Fruitport over to Crockery Creek to get the logs. They gave up trying to run them down that particular stream. So I think the logging history of Ottawa County is fascinating. The white pine era comes to an end approximately 1890. There's very little white pine left. just a few isolated stands. But there is another era called the hardwood logging era. The hardwood logging area, up until the development of the furniture industry in Grand Rapids, most hardwoods were just burned. They might cut them up for fuel for the steamships and so on. Grand Haven was a major source for firewood fuel for the steamboats and for Chicago. It wasn't just white pine lumber that we were shipping out. The hardwood era is really another famous era, and I've got some of my favorites. I just talked about the Glendon Lumber Company. I'm not going to talk very briefly, and then we'll show some slides on the Allendale Timber Company. Now, one of the things we got out of Grand Valley on the north side of our campus is a nature trail. And when we laid out our nature trail, I thought we were laying our nature trail out on an old abandoned wagon road. I couldn't understand why there was some ties thrown around there, but nah, I'm fine with me about ties and water and so on. And then I found out that the last major area in Ottawa County to be logged was a place called the Boltwood Timber Tract, which is the northern part of Grand Valley's campus. Sets on both sides of M45. At the turn of the century, they built a logging railroad on the north side of Grand Valley's campus, almost 50 years after the first one. Nobody at Grand Valley knew anything about this one. I dug this one up by reading some old news accounts, again, microfilm. And they even, in addition to having a little narrow gauge railroad, they even operated a steamboat called the Allendale, which I've come to find information on. But they were cutting hardwood then. Basswood, maple, oak, and so on, and they were taking it to Grand Rapids, to the Grand Rapids Veneer Company. And after they got all the major veneer wood out of it, they sold it to the Grand Haven Basket Company. And the Grand Haven Basket Company operated this boat, this tug, and the steam tug and barge. Basically what it was a push operation. It pushed a barge. Very large barge. Because hardwood doesn't what? It doesn't float. It'll sink after 5-10 miles or less. And consequently, you have to put it into a barge. Well, the Grand Haven Basket Company was provided with logs this way for a number of years. I'm still trying to get more information about that operation. There was a basket company operating, I believe, here in Holland, King's Basket Factory, and they got their logs via log trains from somewhere up north via the Pierre Marquette. I don't know where their property or their timber was up north, but I have seen a news account in this century about trains. They may have been part of a train or a whole separate train, 30 to 40 cars of logs coming into Holland at one time, all going to the King and Company basket factory. Now the logging era continues right up to today. There are sawmills in Ottawa County today. Now I'm concentrating on the 19th century. But I do hope somebody's concentrating on the 20th century. I hope somebody is going to go out there and interview these people so there's some kind of a record. Because it's really difficult to pick up the pieces. Now, I do like being a detective, but it is difficult to pick up the pieces. It's a lot easier when someone records the history a little more accurately than I have been able to in terms of. Well, before I show the slides, are there any questions?
Do you have anything on shack metal operation?
No, but that's one of my favorites because my father was raised. My father went to shack metal. I started first grade at shack metal. I lived on Berry Street for a year, and I think those mills were gone though before
that. I've got some pictures of the sawmill.
I've seen one picture in the been in the river book, the Jenison, the Georgetown Grand book. I'd like to talk to you about making arrangements to get those copies if I could, because I just have a weakness for Chaparral, in addition to Grand Valley's campus. Because, listen, one of the things a biologist ought to do is talk about what's happened to what? The environment in which this campus is on. And I found out, other than we knew that they grew corn, and we knew they grew fruit trees, and we knew it had been logged off before that, we didn't know anything but that. And I think we need to know a little bit more than that. And so I spent a lot of my time trying to find it out.
I think I saw somebody else's.
Where did our leather company get the bark?
Hemlock.
Yeah.
All over the place. The most common tree in Ottawa County was hemlock. The most common of all the trees. We can ascertain that from the surveyor's records. When the surveyors came through and did the section lines, what do you do when you come to a tree and you're trying to measure a straight line? Well, you chop it down, right. You know how long you're going to spend chopping down a tree? That's a good size diameter. That's a lot of wasted time. So anything under 4 inches, they cut down. Anything 4 inches and above, they had a way of measuring right around that and including that in it. And they recorded the diameter of the tree because that was on the line. And they also recorded the species of the tree. And at the section corners, they had to mark what they call what trees. You want to know? They were their markers, basically, so that they made cuts on the sides of these trees, so that at the section corner, so that anyone who came was searching for a piece of property could find the section corner, because a certain distance from a section corner recorded on these sheets would be maple, which was so many chains of, so many parts of a chain away from that corner. And it would give the exact angle so you could find the section corner, so you could find your property. From that kind of information, we estimate, and I think it's fairly reliable, that hemlock was the most common species. Then a couple of hardwoods, and then white pine. White pine was not the most common, but it was here. And it certainly helped out the Hollanders. But the hemlock was what really helped the Hollanders at first, because all you had to do with the hemlock trees was peel it. Well, you had to cut it and then peel it and cure it. And you could, and then also the Dutch did the next thing. Hey, why just send it out? What? Use it ourselves. Construct our own hemlock, yes.
Did that also determine the type of soil?
Hemlock tends to be in a little wetter soil. Pine tends to be in sandy soil. Just as a rule of thumb, there are exceptions to that. Any other questions?
The railroad was a standard size railroad that you were talking about then, wasn't it? Because when Garish...
the one that Garish built was narrow gauge, but the one that operated at Glendon, I believe, was standard gauge, because they purchased their locomotive from Michigan Central. And I couldn't track down the locomotive for a long time until I kept saying the name of the locomotive was Old Joe. And a friend in Pennsylvania who had a roster list of the Michigan Central Railroad said, there's a St. Joseph that shows up on a Michigan Central Railroad in 1850 on the roster and is not there in 1857, the very same year you're saying it's an operation and on the Glendon Lumber Company. And Thayer says that it came from the Michigan Central. Someone else, a historian, one of the historical books in Ottawa County, I think the 1882 book says that it came from the Detroit and Milwaukee. So we have two different sources, but Thayer's been right every time. So I'll go with Thayer, whatever he says from now on. I checked him out 5 times, and he's been right every time. So if the 6th one I can't check out, I'll trust Thayer. But it was a standard gauge operation. And by the way, it's a perfect place to put in a standard gauge operation because it's flat country. We're not dealing with any major hills or ravines or so on. And it was the first attempt, and they had real problems. You ever put in wooden rails? What happens to wood when it warms up, when it gets cold, and so it expands a little bit and so on, contracts a little bit, and you get a little warpage in there, and so you can imagine they had major problems. Now I have had to just take wheels. You think wheels are real easy? Oh, iron was real easy back then? Hey, no way. What are the major logging car manufacturers in the United States? Well, both of the major ones were in Michigan. One was in Detroit, the other was in Grand Rapids. And the one in Grand Rapids for the first 5 years had all kinds of problems with their wheels, as did the others. They had major problems with those wheels breaking because of the tremendous what? Weight that were on those. And they were trying to design wheels, and the mining operations have some similar problems with a heavy weight. So there's some relationship there. Any other questions before the slide?
Did any of these lumbering companies in Kent and Ottawa counties come to be dominated by the lumber barons in the 19th century?
Well, the Cutler and Savage were large operators. The ferries were large operators until they went bankrupt, and then the ferries somehow wound up with some land in Utah and made and became wealthy again as a family in Utah. But when I think of the Grand Rapids operations and Grand Haven operations, I don't think of a really major lumber baron. The Whites and Freonts would be close to that. You know, when I think of a lumber baron, I think of Weyerhaeuser. I think of Blodgett. Now, Blodgett lived in Grand Rapids and never owned a stick in the Grand River Valley, even though there are a couple history books that said he did. I have no evidence. I'm waiting to see that evidence. I haven't gone through all of Blodgett's corporate records, and they exist covering a 50-year period of time. But he did all of his operations in the Muskegon River Valley. His wife wanted to live in Grand Rapids. And so they moved from Muskegon to Grand Rapids. And he was a baron. There's no doubt in my mind the Blodgett family would fall in that category. What happened with a lot of the lumbering company is they invested their money and they lost it in other ventures. That was not uncommon. You know, every now and then when you have a financial penny. One more question, then we'll put this on.
The big lumber fields that were used in the Peninsula, when did they come in and why weren't they used here?
Well, the main reason for not here is they didn't come in early. That would be the main reason. I see those wheels showing up, and I haven't followed that real carefully. You'll see a couple slides of it, but basically, you're talking the 1880s for the big wheels. They're nice for operating during the summertime. Or in the early fall or late spring when there isn't any snow, but the ground is wet, fairly hard. You don't want it real wet because those wheels can sink down. But they were nice for moving logs. They were also nice. Okay, I think you might find these slides to be interesting. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to come back there, and I can talk from back there, and I'm going to go through them very fast because I don't have them well organized. Nonetheless, I think you're going to find some of them to be very interesting. It's a fantastic era. I hope to get together with two or three people and produce a videotape on the environmental history of the Grand River Valley, using some of these and lots of other slides. Some of these slides are from other than the Grand River Valley. It'll give you a feeling for the history, and I have a few maps in here to show you some things that. Okay, this is a forest map of Michigan, and if you look carefully, you can see the outline of Kent and Ottawa counties, and the white pine in terms of its distribution, and some of these are pine, oak forests, and so on, they're not just pine forests, but if you were to do the white pine distribution, start way over on the eastern side of the state, on the northern edge of Lake St. Clair. You see where that little kind of inlet is on the far eastern edge? Okay, you go from there up a little bit, almost to where Flint is, and then you come straight across. You stay north of Ionia, you come across about at Greenville, you come across about at Rockford, and then on the west side of the Grand River, you swing south, almost straight south, right along the Kent County line. And you swing down south through Allegan County and into the northern part of Van Buren County. And the white pine was in clusters. It wasn't solid white pine. Wherever you had sandy soil, you had a high probability, if it was well drained, you had a high probability of having some stands of white pine. I have a weakness for the Upper Peninsula, so I threw that one in. This is an example of a forest map that Larry Brewer, who's from the Holland area, has produced for the counties south of us. This happens to be Gull Lake in the middle and Berry County. He is working on a map of this area. I'm working a little bit with him. I may have finally turned up some money, so if I convince him to work on the project, he can actually get paid. That's really nice. I have a weakness for this area. You can't see it very well. I apologize. It happens to be the Duquamina area. Sheldrake and so on up north. Okay, this is Gerrish's operation, the Lake George and Muskegon River Railroad, 1878. There are no photographs of the Blendon Lumber Company operation. There were photographers in Grand Rapids during the time, but they took pictures, that they made portraits. They did not take outdoor shots for whatever reason. This is an example of a logging car built in Grand Rapids by the Butterworth and Lowe for the Gerrish operations. Some of the first logging cars were built in Grand Rapids. One of the major problems we had with steam locomotives was the fact that they let out cinders and surrounding countryside caught on fire. This is an example of the inventive genius, or her variation, I'm not sure which, of Americans. All those are patented, and all of them are designed to catch cinders and prevent fires from occurring. And some of them worked, many of them did not work very well. This person played a very important role in the history of Michigan logging. He designed a very interesting geared locomotive that was said to be able to do everything except climb a tree. And this geared locomotive was built by him, by Ephraim Shea of Herring. Really fantastic. Notice this does not have drive wheels. It has little gears. This thing did not slip backwards. And it didn't go fast, but it could haul. And not only that, the front wheels and back wheels could be at a different angle, so you could turn on almost a dime. And so you'd get railroad tracks that would literally snake through the woods, around this stump and around that stump. Here's another view of this operation. These are not in the Grand River Valley. These Shea locomotives were built right up to this century. These are some examples of this century down in West Virginia. Branding irons. Branding irons were necessary when you had log drives. I have found the brand iron hammer for the Blendon Lumber Company. I didn't expect to find it in existence, but it still exists. This one, I believe, is for Ryerson Hills and Company. Muskegon. That's another fascinating operation. This is up in Newaygo. I'll show you Newaygo County. I'll show you a couple slides and then we'll go on to the Grand River Valley Trail. This is an example of how the forest looked on one of the sleigh roads. So they would move the logs on sleighs pulled by horses. In the background is a famous 100-horse barn. This is an operation up by Pickerel Lake. Huge. You can see how they put the logs up on the rail cars. Notice that they put logs so they can roll them up, and notice the person up in the top? He is operating a little chain to help move that up. I would not stand where those men are standing below. Because if the chain gave, they would also give under the weight of that log. And it was not unusual for logging accidents. They were very, very common. Newspapers are full of them. This is the winter scene, logs banked up by the 100 horse barn by, this is up by Ryerson Long Lake, by Pickerel Lake. Notice how this kind of snakes through the woods. Look at the locomotive up ahead. It's a Shea locomotive, and if it's not going in the same direction that these logs are, it's already gone around a turn. This is another shot of this Shea locomotive operation up just north of Muskegon River. This is their dumping ground into Pickerel Lake. Kept their logs in Pickerel Lake. They even used a tugboat to move the logs across Pickerel Lake. On the other side of Pickerel Lake, they pulled their logs up, put it on another train. This is a little porter engine here. They moved this, and this is their work crew, by the way. These are shots taken in the late 1880s. They must have been dressed in their Sunday best for this. This shows the train operating through a section they've already logged. And then the famous log slide, which is just on the, if you stand at the Powerhouse Museum in Nuevo, this is just the other side of the river. And this is the famous sorting grounds of the Muskegon River, the flats just above Muskegon. Got shots of the mills and so on, but I'll show those another time. This is shot with respect to the Grand River Valley. This is the Grand River as it exists today in the Georgetown Township, Linden Township area. We're dealing with very small trees compared to the past. Forests still are beautiful, but nothing compared to the past. Okay, this is a view of the Grand River. It's a map. I wish I had a pointer, but if you look in the very southwestern corner of Kent County, and Kent County is on an angle with respect to this map, you can see Buck Creek, it's not labeled, and you can see Rush Creek. Two small streams, which is where the first logging occurred in the Grand River Valley. It's about 5,600 square miles, if I remember correctly. It's a very large river basin. All the white pine came from north of the river until you got to Granville, and then you got some of it south of the river. This is an example of one of the early water-powered sawmills. The water wheel was an undershot wheel. The water flowed under the wheel and turned the wheel. And then there is a frame to the left of the wheel. Up toward the top of the frame going through the log is a saw, one saw. This would be called a upright saw or a sash saw mounted in a frame. And it would depend on, in part, how much water, what power was available. Whenever possible, when lumbermen had enough money, they put in a steam boiler so they didn't have to rely on water. Later on, they would have numerous saws mounted in that frame, and you'd have a game saw.
And then, of course, you got circular saws as well. Most sawmills had both circular saws and gangs of upright saws. When they made a cut, you could see, I'm going to have to reshoot this to concentrate just on the diameter section so you could see how they would cut it. But this is the first time I've seen these slides myself. I'm going to have to redo them so they come out better next time. But there's a lot of the log that winds up sawdust. So they get different cuts from the same log. Now, this is how they built a lumber raft. The very bottom frame is what we call the crib. And it has grub pins, which are probably made of oak, and they anchored the ends. And then lumber was piled on this. And then shingles and lath was piled on top of it. And several hundred million feet of lumber went down the Grand River to Grand Haven, to the docks at Grand Haven, where it was then loaded on the docks and then transloaded onto lumber schooners, primarily for Chicago. Well, some of the early lumber, believe it or not, went to Wisconsin, to Milwaukee. It was cheaper to buy the lumber in Grand Haven than to buy it from the interior of Wisconsin. These lumber rafts were a fantastic dimension, important era, completely lost era in terms of the, completely forgotten in terms of the history of logging. And when you talk about hundreds of millions of feet being moved this way, I think it deserves a little page in our history books. Okay, this is the western part of Ottawa County. And you can see Fruitport up at the very, very top. Somewhere up near Fruitport was the first or second logging railroad. Both of them were built in 1850, one of them by Hopkins up there. This is a map that's hard to read. The map, the original, is hard to read. This is an 1864 map. And if you knew where to look, you could see three logging railroads on it. Now, I put them on a regular map. I drew the logging railroads in red. Grand Rapids, M45 goes straight across, east to west, in red, just above where it says Allendale. That's M45. Okay, the first red line that goes on an angle down is the Blendon Lumber Company Railroad. There were two other horse-drawn railroads I didn't even mention. One operated by the Ohio Dock Company and another one by Weatherwax and Ferry. There were at least seven logging railroads operating in the Grand River Valley in Ottawa County before the end of the Civil War. Grand Haven and Mill Point, Ferrysburg were loaded with sawmills. These are some of the log marks. You have the little pig with a squirrel with a squiggly tail. That was Quimby's. Cutler and Savage, they weren't particularly innovative. They had CNS 1, CNS 2, CNS 3, CNS 10, but it got them the logs, and that's all it counted. And one of these, I tell you, I would never use number 4. Anyone know why I wouldn't use number 4?
Change.
Right, I could change it into 9. You betcha. That's why I wouldn't use number 4. Number 4 is that straight line up there, that stick. And I can see the guys working for 9 saying, we'd like this log. And that was a major problem, timber theft in the old days. Still occurs today, unfortunately. Numerous sawmill sites in Grand Haven, Spring Lake area. These are out of Lily's book, which is an excellent source to have. this is the rest of them. And the Norton Mill is just above the sign here. It says Mills and Shipyards. Norton Mill was a very important mill, particularly for Blendon, because a lot of their lumber was cut there. This is Cutler and Savage's crew, probably somewhere up north of Six Lakes. Cutler and Savage had crews all over the place, but they had a huge operation up above Six Lakes, the beginning of the Flat River. And you can see the crosscut saw they're using as they butt the end of this log. Whoops. I'm gonna get going the right way again. There was a major change in crosscut saws. Before 1876, they chopped the tree down. After 1876, they chopped a notch and then crosscut it down. And it's because of the way they changed the teeth. Because after 1876, the teeth would pull the sawdust out and they could saw a tree down very, very rapidly. Little technological advances like this played a major role in speeding up the rate at which the forest came down. This is one of the sawmills in Grand Haven. I haven't had a chance to get back to Grand Haven to look at the map, the photographs to identify which one. I just got these slides yesterday. This, I think, is the famous Red Mill or Boyce Imlaw Mill in Grand Haven. There's quite a story about those little barrels up at the top. I think every mill hand felt safer, but there's no evidence that they ever did anything other than collect rainwater. When one of these mills caught on fire, nobody had time to get up there to turn any of those barrels over. This is a photograph from the big sand dune on the opposite side of the Grand River from Grand Haven. Unfortunately, it's kind of washed out. It's hard to see. This is the famous shingle mill of the Grand Haven Lumber Company, the Boyden and Ackley operation. When this was built, I think around 1881, it was the largest shingle mill in the world. It could produce 100,000 shingles an hour. This is unbelievable. They had a crew of over 200 men working there. The mill hands called it the sausage factory. If you know anything about occupational safety, you know why they call it the sausage factory. You're dealing with shingle machines with lots of knives on them. I've located the drawings for the construction of that mill and the insides. This one, if you look carefully, this is a view from the top looking down. Those circular objects are shingle making machines. They are up on the second floor of this operation. And they would produce the shingles, and the shingles would drop down to the ground floor where they had a crew of a couple of dozen men and boys picking up the shingles and moving them out. Fantastic large operation. Oops, this is another view of that shingle. That's this group. Now, for those of you that want to see the famous log jam of Grand River Valley, if I can get this set in the right place, we can start off. This won't take too long, but I'll show you. The logs were really stacked up in Grand Rapids. They were stacked up for miles above the bridge at the Detroit-Milwaukee Bridge, which became the Grand Trunk Bridge. That bridge held for several days and then gave way. And something like, I think, 20 million board feet of logs went through in 1 hour. It tore out every bridge in town except one. It was a sight to see. That's a view of some of the flats south of Grand Rapids afterwards. Just logs all over the place. This is a shot in Grand Rapids. Those are all the people out walking. And of course you got flooding because of these, of the huge log jam. Some more of the logs, and we've got some photographs of some of the bridges. There is a former bridge that was knocked down by the log jam as it came through.
What year is this?
1883. Even made Harper's Weekly front cover several etchings. Fortunately, this bridge could turn. That's what saved it. Most of the logs went between the piers, fortunately, and they were able to turn the bridge and save a good part of this one. Some of the other bridges, well, this is down by, this is south of Grand Rapids. In spite of the little legend that White in his famous writings engendered, there's no evidence that any part of any of the bridges made it all the way to Grand Haven. Well, I do like that legend. But most of them made it several miles downstream, down to the Lakeshore Michigan Southern Bridge, where they met a sizable barrier, and that bridge, for whatever reason, held. And these are some of the people out standing in front of that, on that log jam that held by this particular bridge. Most of it went under the bridge, but some of it jammed up by this bridge too. So you have an appreciation of the power of this log jam. Look at the tracks. Those tracks were straight before. There was a bridge there before. There are only piers there now. The bridge is several miles downstream in pieces. There are some of the pieces stacked up. Some of these are the Grand Rapids and Indiana Bridge, as well as the Grand Trunk for the Detroit-Milwaukee Bridge. They were moved down several miles before they lodged. There's another shot of bridges so you get an idea of the power of that. Now, Grand Haven knew they were coming. Grand Haven knew that somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 million logs or more were on their way. And they worked hard in Grand Haven to stop this. One of the things they did was dig a channel into Stearns Bayou and get some of the logs moved in that direction. And they also built a huge boom across the river in addition to the booms they already had. And they were able to hold the booms. So about 15 million board feet were put back on to railroad cars and hauled back to Grand Rapids from Ferrysburg. Another 5 billion million board feet were sold to Grand Haven mill owners. Well, if you've got a sawmill in Grand Rapids, you want to saw logs. What do you do when all your logs are in Grand Haven? You either close down your mill or you have them shipped back. So they shipped them back. And one last shot of one of the bridges. Well, thank you. I hope you've learned a little bit about very fascinating.